I'm Dave Peterson. I'm a project scientist here at UCSD, and I'm so excited that the organizers asked me to give a talk because I felt like I had an excuse to talk about precisely what I wanted to. So I'm going to tell you about my research passion and try to make the big leap here between STDP and neurology, spike timing dependent plasticity, for those of you that don't know. So my passion is a neurologic disorder called dystonia. It's a movement disorder that has many different forms, and this little pictorial shows just a few of them. There are patients that have problems with motor control in their hands, in their feet, arms, neck, truncal areas, and the basic problem is the loss of voluntary motor control. But it's a partial loss, and oftentimes it's task specific. We'll talk more about that later. And to try to give you a more concrete illustration of it, I want to see if I can get this video to work. The audio is irrelevant. I just want you to get a visual for this. But this is of a patient. It's a fairly severe patient that has a form of dystonia that involves the cranial and cervical musculature. Let's see if we can. And of course, it looks like it's loading. You know what? For the sake of time, you know what? Ah, here we go. Oh. Of course, as with all of these things, it worked right before, during the break. But suffice to say, I could give you my attempt at a demonstration. So these patients, it's very troubling. So many of them lose voluntary control of the periocular musculature, so they may blink excessively, sometimes to the point where it's disabling where they can't drive. And also oromandibular, lower cranial muscles, and cervical muscles, where you can either get a fixed or tremor component, typically in this dimension or retroantero or lateral. But as you might imagine, not only is it potentially very functionally disabling, it can be exceedingly socially disabling. And this disorder has one of the highest suicide rates, unfortunately, of many neurologic disorders. The prevalence, although it's the third most common movement disorder after Parkinson's disease and essential tremor, it's more common than something like Huntington's disease, which many of you probably have heard of. And the course, although it's not neurodegenerative like Parkinson's disease and Huntington's, it is chronic and it's stable and very few patients remit, and the treatment is quite impoverished. People have tried dopaminergic and cholinergic medications, really to no avail, except in a few select patients. Botulinum neurotoxin, or Botox, as some of you may have heard of it, is, although widely known for its cosmetic use, is also extensively used in focal dystonias because it stops the transmission of the neuromuscular junction. And then some of the severe patients that are refractory to some of these other approaches have undergone stereotactic surgeries where they've either had ablation or these days, much more commonly, deep brain stimulation in basal ganglion nuclei. And many of you have seen these cartoonish pictures from the primary purveyor of these devices, Medtronic. And it's essentially a sledgehammer in the brain. They're just using the same technology they've used for heart pacemakers for many decades with slight modifications in deep brain nuclei. So here's a coronal section. I don't know if you can see it. But the green, this more medial green section here is the internal segment of the globus pallidus, part of the basal ganglia, one of the main output nuclei, and that is where DBS is typically done in dystonia patients. The subthalamic nucleus is the main target in Parkinson's disease. So if I'm talking to a group of neurologists, which is my more common practice the past couple of years or two, 1 or 2 years, I never use the four-letter word that begins with C, and I think most of them don't either, but I think we all know that this is our ultimate goal. How do we cure this disease, right? And many others. And I'm not so naive to think that it's going to be easy or even possible necessarily, but whether it's a year out or 10 years or realistically several generations out, I think it's a goal we should keep on the radar. And so the big question I've got is, how do we fix this? Right? And, you know, most of medicine is working out here, either in a treatment clinical capacity, right, trying to put Band-Aids on symptoms, or studying the pathophysiology to try to get some clues about it once the disease is present. But of course, that comes sometime after they're first diagnosed. And tragically, even today, There are many patients I talked to that took years, in some cases decades, to be properly diagnosed between when the disease symptoms were onset and they had a correct diagnosis. It is amazing, but it's also understandable why when you go to these neurologic meetings, 90% of what they talk about is diagnosis. How do we diagnose things? What do we call this? What's the taxonomy for it? And then you have a table that maps that to a treatment strategy. That is neurology, right? That's neurology. And so the big question is, my working strategy is, if we have a better understanding on how we got there, what was the pathogenesis, what led to the pathology, we can have a better hope of treating it and ultimately reversing it. So how do we get at pathogenic mechanisms? Because Terry isn't here today, I had to show his classic figure depicting the different levels of analysis in the nervous system. And this is a helpful construct for many purposes, including my approach to this stuff. So, you know, there's a lot of work being done with behavioral and clinical kind of phenotyping, you know, top-down perspective of the disorder. And then likewise from bottom-up, of course, with the explosion in genomics the past 10, 20 years, there's a lot of, and I'll talk about some recent work in the genes of dystonia and protein function. The big question is, how do these things link? And most of us that work in neuroscience have a deep appreciation for the complexity of everything in between. So I want to, for the sake of the temporal dynamics of learning center context, mention briefly, it's helpful to think about these things at multiple timescales, right? So you've got the timescale of years in the course of the disease, the timescale of minutes or seconds for motor function or loss thereof, and then, you know, it's a big gulf here, but down to the millisecond level in terms of synaptic activity, which underlies all that function. But I think it's helpful to shift earlier. And like I said, look at pathogenesis. So here the question is, you know, what are the learning processes? And the motor learning processes that go from normal motor function, where the overwhelming majority of these patients have adult onset. They had normal motor function most of their lives. So how do they learn abnormal motor function? And I'll talk briefly later about how it's really abnormal motor sequence learning, I think, and abnormal synaptic plasticity that might underlie that. I'm going to complement a lot of what Mark talked about with a cortical focus on, a little bit more of a focus on the basal ganglia. So, of course, these systems interact extensively to give rise to ultimate motor function. One thing I want to highlight, you know, I think we talked with Howard's question there at the end about the influence of M1 on motor function and then the basal ganglia influence on motor cortex. I think a helpful view and helpful construct that maps to Emma's approach to this stuff is what you're really seeing in the ultimate motor output for a given point in time is a superposition of many influences, right? You've got a superposition of stuff from M1. You've got a superposition of stuff from a whole bunch of complex spinal cord brainstem circuitry that to this date, we don't know that anatomy as well as we know cortical anatomy. But it's really the temporal superposition of those influences that gives rise to really the motor function we're seeing out of the spinal cord. So a helpful thing to remember is that basal ganglia output, although we focus on the output pathway back to cortex, also has a hugely important descending influence directly to brainstem. And for those of you that are interested in this, Sten Grillner has talked about this very nicely in a lot of his work for a couple decades now. But the important things for this talk, basal ganglion function includes a lot of things, including action selection and learning how to choose the right action or motor output in a given context. And it's relevant for a number of disorders we don't have time to talk about today. What I want to talk about is our theoretical framework for how to approach this. There's many different forms of dystonia, and some of them are generalized, involving the whole body. Some are more focal. And our general thinking is that, we laid this out in a review paper a couple of years ago, you could view this as just another simple instantiation of nature and nurture, right? You know, on the one axis, you've got nature, some biologic substrate that's abnormal. And it may not be limited to synaptic plasticity abnormalities in the striatum. I'll talk about that, but I think that's a core piece of the puzzle. And on the other dimension is activity, environment, behavior, sensory motor use. So there are some forms of dystonia, like musician's dystonia, I'll talk about later, that are much more prevalent. And the theory is that part of the causal factor is the extensive use of restricted parts of that state to action space that are a contributing factor. For those of you that come from a machine learning background, it's easy to map this to reinforcement learning, right? You've got reinforcing signals happening in the basal ganglia, usually dopamine mediated. And then how do you sample your state action space? That's reinforcement learning, right? So let's zoom in on the top-down stuff first. So I'm taking a multi-pronged approach to this. So first, how do we measure motor function in these patients? And why is it important? So, you know, there's the whole question of how does the disease progress for purposes of clinical studies that are looking at natural history, and then most importantly for patients, clinical trials, when they're testing different serotypes of the botulinum neurotoxins, you know, how do the pre and post compare? How do different treatments compare? If you don't have good measures, all bets are off, right? So motor measures are critically important here. And then also for the patients, not just which are the best treatments, but can the motor measures give us some predictive ability on how efficacious the treatment's going to be? So we can set expectations in pretreatment counseling and say, look, you're going to get 10% better. This isn't going to be a cure-all. Right? And most importantly for our, from a more scientific perspective is, you know, there's all these sophisticated pathophysiologic, biologic measures we bring to bear on the problem, from genetics to fMRI, to DTI, to EEG, all of our spectral analyses with EEG, all of our dynamical systems perspectives on the physiology, right? We've got all these amazing quantitative tools at our disposal, and we're trying to reconcile them or correlate them with motor measures that are completely impoverished. So it's analogous to the thing Scott's always talked about where, you know, we've got all these fantastic EEG measures that are so high dimensional, and, you know, we're measuring very low one-dimensional twitches in a typical laboratory setting. So there's, from the clinical side, there's many different options for studying motor function in dystonia patients, typically in the form of what they call rating scales. There are many options. There's no clear standards. Where there are standards, they're often not used. Many clinicians, when you talk to them, will say, well, I know it when I see it. Right? And many of the scales are simple ordinal scales. Well, rate it on a 1 to 5. 0 is good and 5 is bad, and then there's the numbers in between, right? And then they're also very subjective. These are humans doing these ratings. So you have a question not only of, okay, did clinician A give it the same number that clinician B would have? And tons of federal funding for clinical trials have gone into paying for people to do that, right? But also the intra-rater variability. Well, if I'm clinician A, am I going to give it the same number today that I would give them tomorrow, everything else being equal? Maybe, maybe not, right? So let's focus on a specific example, the dystonias involving the cranial musculature. So, you know, there's a lot of muscles there. We all know this. And there's these cutesy layperson things, you know, well, there's only 7 emotions. Or, you know, at the other end of the spectrum, well, if we've got, you know, N muscles and, you know, assume for sake of simplicity that they're all independent, 2 to the N different muscle combinations, even if we're just talking in a binary sense, right? If there aren't gradations of their activation. And that's only for a given slice in time. Of course, it's their, you know, precise temporal sequencing, which really gives rise to facial expressions, et cetera, right? So it's a combinatorial, you know, explosively combinatorial problem. And I think one approach that many people here are familiar with that Marnie's been so instrumental in developing for a long time now is CERT. All right, we've used this for many different domains. And the first time I saw her demo, I thought, my God, we've got to try this with cranial dystonia patients, right? Pathetic if we didn't. And it's got all these benefits, of course. It's continuous value. Yeah, Gary?
What's CERT?
Computer Expression Recognition Toolbox. Did I get that right, Marnie? How many of you are not familiar with CERT? Will we have a demo today, as usual? Tonight? Will someone be demoing it? All right, I can too, afterwards. It's fantastic. It'll give, in crude sense, it'll give you a continuously valued over time measure of the relative level of activation of facial muscles from still frames from video, right? So I'll skip the details here, but the important point is it can give us this nice, relatively temporally precise measure of activation of these muscles objectively. If I give the same video to CERT tomorrow, it'll give me the same answer it did today, right? Of course. And so in our preliminary tests with videos from patients, and you might imagine since it's face video and this is patient data, the IRB issues are non-trivial. But we were able to collaborate with a number of different clinical groups to get some of this video data. And in our preliminary tests, it's essentially multivariate linear regression. Our CERT measures of severity have been demonstrated to be statistically significantly correlated with the clinical ratings. So this is kind of a first gut check with the clinicians to say, hey, this is a viable approach. This is actually one of their new ones that is 0 to 12. Still ordinal and still humans. Right. So let's focus on this extreme case I mentioned earlier of musician's dystonia, where I think that there's a particularly heavy influence from this component. So we've started to look at this literature, and this is a paper that's under review currently in neurology, where if you look at, so one of the nice things about dystonia is not only might it provide us an interesting model of motor learning, I mean, HM has been a fantastic disease model of hippocampal function for a long time, right? It's a classic canonical model. Well, I think that analogously, if we study the pathogenesis of dystonia, it can provide a neurologic model, a patient model for motor learning. And the nice thing about dystonia is if you look at the literature on it, it's only, say, maybe 10,000 papers, on the order of 10,000 papers, right? So it's a little bit more tractable than something like Parkinson's. And in musicians' dystonia in particular, it's nice because the literature is only about 250 papers. And then if you look at that briefly, a lot of it's reviews, but about 135 papers do some sort of experimental study. And the funny thing is, if you look at those, almost half, 46% of them, had only qualitative measures of motor function. Many of these in the quantitative category used both quantitative and qualitative measures. And then if you look at the number of different rating scales clinicians have used, it's on the order of a dozen. And the two biggest categories here are both others, here and here. They're catch basins for a bunch of different ways of measuring these symptoms for which there are no names and they're not standardized. And so we'll come back to that later, but one of the important things to keep in mind here is if you look at just a snapshot of a handful of the papers that are looking at interventions in musicians' dystonia mapped against these different scales, different studies use different scales, as you might expect. There's no clear standards, right? But the important point here is, well, if we're comparing different interventions, if there's different efficacy, we don't know if it's because of different interventions or different measurements, right? Is this a measurement effect? All that time, effort, and funding is not being appropriately directed, right? So one of the projects we've got underway, I'm working with some people in Mount Sinai, New York, and some people that are very heavily into this in Germany, is to develop a new rating scale for musicians' dystonia that leverages a couple of the existing ones to try to get the best of both worlds, where you've got an objective tool and some subjective complements that cover things that the objective tools cannot measure. I'll skip the details, but one important point to note here is that in preliminary tests of this MSA scale, they're basically using MIDI from piano. One of the most sensitive measures of severity was the inter-onset intervals and how they were variable over time, right? So it's consistent with all the, you know, temporally exquisite things we've seen and talked about in TDLC for years. Sorry, Paul. So it's the digital interface for musical instrument digital interface, I think. So it's just a way to pull data in a digital format from an instrument if it's MIDI compatible. And many pianos are electric pianos. So these guys, I won't go into too much detail, but briefly, they look at the inner onset interval when musicians are playing scales, right, between different key presses, and the temporal regularity of that, the variability of that inner onset interval, the onset of the key press. Okay, and then the other focus of my research is coming at it from the bottom up. Now, ultimately, hopefully, before I die, I want to get these bridged. But I realistically think it's a multi-decade endeavor, so I hope I live a long time for other reasons too. But I'll skip some details here, but an important point is that many of the dystonia genes that have been found, and there aren't many, and they account for a very small minority of the patients, but many of them have been implicated in, among other things, cellular signaling pathways that have to do with dopamine. And this is just a little slide depicting how a couple of proteins that a couple of genes code for, one's called TORSIN-AThap1, that's irrelevant, are involved in trafficking and the function of dopamine receptors out at the cell membrane, okay? And I'll talk more about these later. And a very recent finding, just a couple months ago in Nature Genetics, people in the dystonia community are very excited because they're starting to do the exome, you know, the deep sequencing of genes of some of these patients so they can get at what's abnormal a little bit better than you can from GWAS studies. And that is this it's a G-alpha ULF subunit of the D1 type of dopamine receptor. And as you might know, these some of these, especially the G-protein-coupled receptors, are extremely complex, many different subunits. And the subunit composition can have a significant influence on their function and therefore cell physiology, right, in response to dopamine. Well, the interesting finding is the abnormality in this gene, it has been implicated in some dystonia patients, involves a different subunit in this lower plot here is showing the normal S subunit for this G-protein coupled receptor out in cortex. This is a rodent, obviously, if you're familiar with these coronal images. And then the other one, the substituted unit here that's abnormal in this form of dystonia, is selectively in striatum, suggesting the basal ganglia function, right? And then another big recent gene finding in dystonia, again, just last year, looked at the intensity of this gene called, I think it's enoctin 3. Different versions of it are implicated in different disorders, for example, like cancer, right? These are general cellular functions. But this specific one, although they haven't firmly determined what the protein it codes for is doing yet, when they've assayed the amount of it in different brain regions, you can't read this lower axis, I can't either. I just know that this one is putamen, dorsal striatum. So here again, it's pointing toward the striatum, this main input structure in the basal ganglia. The theorized function of this protein is that it acts as a calcium-activated chloride channel on the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum. I'm curious about the neurobiologic and cell biology knowledge in here. How many of you know what the ER is? Good, that's decent. Okay. So, among other things, and I'm not an expert on cell physiology either, but an important function of the ER, an endoplasmic reticulum, it's a compartment inside all cells, but especially in neurons, is that it provides a mechanism for rapidly and dynamically changing the concentration of calcium in the cytoplasm, which is critical for all kinds of cellular signaling pathways, including ultimately synaptic plasticity, which we all talk about and know that is the basis of many of the forms of learning we study. So in our review paper a few years ago, we had a depiction of all the different cell types in the striatum. And red here, the important take home for you is that red here is depicting where all the different dopamine receptors are. There's many different types of them. But they're present on all these different cell types. So, you know, one of the open questions is, how is dopamine modulating plasticity at those many different types of synapses? So to begin to get at this, we took physiologic data from slice experiments in rodent where they looked at STDP at some of these synapses, especially the synapse from cortex to striatum, and built a simple continuous valued computational kernel model of it. And I won't go into the math here. It's pretty simple. And then we basically looked at this, and we anchored this by experimental data that looked specifically with genetically modified mice at the different pathways in basal ganglia that have the D1 or the D2 types of dopamine receptors. So these are just kernels, if you will, where instead of just a function of time, like normally with STDP, the weight change or the change in the synapse strength is also a function of the dopamine concentration in some abstract sense, right? So in different scenarios of different dopamine concentrations, you're going to have different changes in the synapse strength as a function of the timing of the presynaptic and postsynaptic cells. But an open question is, does this hold for the other types of synapses? Some of those afferent neurons are GABAergic as opposed to glutamatergic, as are the ones from cortex and from thalamus. So one of the things that I want to work on next is, okay, can we unify a lot of the different experimental data that is suggesting these subtle dopamine influences on STDP with the calcium-based model? Now, it might seem at first blush that, oh, geez, we're going from a pretty low level down to an even deeper level once you start talking about calcium. But, you know, A, this road has been traveled before in the absence of dopamine. So Harold Chauval, who's, I think, in Texas, has done some very nice work, and this is a plot from his paper, where he's got a general notion of postsynaptic activation that's characterized by intracellular, or I should say cytosolic calcium concentration that is a key factor in how the timing here is also modulating the synapse strength. And there's a fair amount of data on those different dopamine receptor subclasses on their and their influences on intracellular calcium. So I think that there's some potentially fertile ground there, and I want to talk to, is Dan Feldman here, or will be this time? Is he? At some point in the future, I want to talk to Dan Feldman, get his input on this and how to come up with a more unifying strategy for accounting for neuromodulators' influence on STVP, perhaps with a calcium-based mechanism. And I'll remind you again that that earlier gene we noticed was coding for calcium-activated chloride channels on the ER. Again, evidence for intracellular calcium dynamics as a potential mediating factor in abnormal synaptic plasticity in this syndrome. So I want to wrap up and keep this short. The simple take home I want you to remember is, you know, the temporal dynamics of learning, especially in the context of dopamine's role in that function, is potentially going to play a very synergistic role with neurologic disorders, well beyond dystonia, but that's my focus. And I think it's a good case study. And the interaction is potentially very synergistic. I want to thank a lot of people, but especially, you know, Terry's group. I probably say all kinds of things since he's not here, but this is being recorded. But Terry's group over at Salk is just such a fantastic intellectual environment for developing ways of thinking about things. So, I mean, we have this auto-associative mapping between Terry and modeling, and that's an important function of much of what we do over there. But I think the bigger picture of, you know, many different people working on many different things at many different levels of analysis in the nervous system, but having constant dialogue and extensive intellectual dialogue about all these things in a very broad sense is the kind of environment that is very difficult to beat. And I really thank all my colleagues there for everything that they've done to contribute to the development of these ideas. So I should point out, not only has Terry been very supportive in enabling this work, but also a lot of this work started with my early postdoc days through a partially funded TDLC project with Howard. And also the CERT stuff obviously has been instrumentally helped by Marnie and Gwen Bartlett. I don't know if Gwen's here today, but they were critical in getting this off the ground, and I'm very excited about that line of research. There's a group at Washington University that is helping us with the patient data, and then groups in Italy and Germany on some of the other patient data and the musicians' dystonia work. And I want to thank, of course, our sources, not only TDLC, you know, not just for the financial support, but for the kind of collegial environment that I've really benefited from for the past few years here. It's really been a joy, and intellectually and personally. And then both NINS and NIMH at NIH have supported this work, as well as a current project with Howard Scott and Gert Kauenbergs through NSF, and then a few dystonia foundations, which have been critical and have obviously a deep interest in this work. And thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
So you said you're working on a new scale. What are your plans to getting it adopted broadly? I mean, clearly people have a lot of different habits here.
That's a good question. And it's a little bit of this is kind of a meta-level problem that we all face in different versions. So the proponents of those various scales that have been used in the past, of course, are they have certain affinity for their own scales that they've developed. And so literally the first project we proposed and got funded is strictly, I wanted to get all these people in one room at one time where there's no other objective but to discuss what might be some sort of a, or at least strive toward consensus. So, right, of course, good luck. Right? And I assume that we will not get there. But I hope that we at least get some traction in that direction and at least highlight the issues to the point where people realize, you know, here's the pluses and minuses of all the different things we can measure. And an important thing here, of course, is clinical utility. It's got to be something that can be used readily in the clinic with minimal requirements in the way of infrastructure and process, people, knowledge, et cetera. Yeah. Paula.
Well, there is a general movement in this direction across multiple fields, and you probably know about the NIH toolbox. It was a similar idea that everybody uses their own set of measures of cognitive ability, developmental cognitive ability or whatever. And, you know, 100 measures of memory, different measures of this and that and the other, and they got a group of people together and over a period of time came to some consensus and developed what's called the NIH toolbox. And then NIH gives preference to grants that are planning to use the NIH toolbox. So the idea is that ultimately we would be able to compare across studies a lot better in terms of the kinds of functions that are being assessed. So I think it's a wonderful thing you're doing, and it's really been needed in the motor domain for a long time, and I think the technology has really caught up. In development, it's really interesting because the pediatric neurologists have what are called developmental soft signs. They have their entire battery of developmental soft signs, and what we came to find was that that was great, except for no one knew how many times should a normal or a typical five-year-old do this in 30 seconds, right? And how many motor or mirror movements, on the other hand, is typical at five, and how about at six, and how about at seven? But neurologists have been using these for years, I mean, literally years, and they just have their own intuition, and that's what they're trained for. I mean, that is what their training is, to pick up what they know is outside the norm. But the problem is, over time, they don't see very many typical children. So that kind of, you know, so having quantitative scales, even, and developmental scales for the kind of work you're doing, because you're talking about what are the precursors.
Yeah.
And it's not just dystonia, as you said. I mean, there's so many of these neurological disorders, developmental and degenerative, that involve the motor system that this could be applied to. So I think it's great.
Does your work to date give you hope for dynamic therapies?
Yeah, thanks, Scott. That's a good question, and I didn't really touch on that. But part of the idea of this two dimensions of neurobiologic abnormality and use-dependent abnormality, well, if you want to reverse things, one simple idea is instead of just modulating one or the other independently, we should modulate both and try to go the other direction. So tactically, what that means, I think, is modulating the neurobiologic substrate through pharmacologic methods of some sort, you know, pill pushing that most of medicine does, right? Carefully coordinated with things under the umbrella of physical therapies, maybe, right? Where, you know, if you, for example, and this is just purely speculative, but if you've got different dopaminergic agents with different time courses, time constants in their levels of activation, right? If you could use some of those or combinations of those in conjunction with and very closely temporally aligned, you know, on the order of days, minutes, or hours and minutes with PT therapy, and where you can get the PTs to talk with the MDs.
What about
which rarely happens?
What about the adding the third dimension, which would be electromagnetic stimulation?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So people have tried.
Precisely timed. Yeah.
Yeah. So people have done some stuff with TMS, for example, out in various cortical areas and tried to do that. But I think that's one potentially good route that's non-invasive and actually kind of gets at both of those activity-dependent things and the biology. Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
Let me add a question.
Yeah.
And I regret asking this, but do you see any common ground or any relationship between what you talked about and what the previous speaker talked about?
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a good question. Thanks. And I should have added some more segue-ish type of comments. It's interesting because, in fact, I'll just talk about it now on the fly. It's something I want to talk about with Mark later offline. And that is when I see his temporally acute sinusoids, right? They're like phase-shifted sinusoidal bases, right? And when I see that, what I'm thinking is that's probably and this is speculation, but it may be a superposition of inputs in M1 from more frontal areas and from the thalamic ascending inputs from basal ganglia. And that the way that those things get formed over time during motor learning probably involves dopaminergic modulation in the basal ganglia component of that circuit and the relative timing of influences from that pathway and more anterior premotor planning areas. That's just one example. Okay, so that's a very good question. So my hunch on the pathophysiology is that it's really, a lot of it is disordered timing of the superposition of these different components. So you might predict that in something like dystonia, if we were to measure M1 in a primate model of dystonia, if we could create one, that it would be some abnormal temporal patterning of those things where you'd see, you know, you wouldn't see these nice, clean, classic dynamical system loops. But that's speculation. Right. In fact, is Bill here?
Bill here.
Ah, so he might know this work too.
Actually, Bill's right here.
Right. So you guys are probably intimately familiar with that work. So with Nancy Beale, years ago, Mike Mersenick developed a primate model of focal hand dystonia, where they didn't change anything in the animals biologically. It was strictly a extensive use dependent handling of a manipulatum that was vibrating. It's a highly debated animal model in the clinical community because it hasn't been replicated since then. But notwithstanding that caveat, I think that it says a lot about what's going on. But I think it's a specific case where they focused on changes in sensory cortical areas. But they didn't look at the changes in motor cortical areas, to my recollection. And it would have been interesting to look at that physiology in precisely the fashion I was just talking about with respect to Mark's work. Thanks.